Thank you. Well, this presentation is mostly written by my co-author, Charlotte Singer, who was an honor student who was very interested in urban agriculture. And our topic is, why is there so much interest in urban agriculture and does it pay? Just to give you some background, the movement of agriculture back and forth between urban and rural. Because of improvements in technology and transportation in the 19th and 20th century, agriculture tended to move more and more out into the rural areas, where it was cheaper cost of production. And the returns to mechanized labor relative to the returns to manual labor, of course, increased. So as we saw more mechanization, we saw the growth of these industrialized urban farms out in the rural areas and a decline of the small urban farm that we had seen some of before that. If you look at this graph, you see at the beginning of the 1900s, there was a huge drop in the number of farms. At the same time, there was a huge increase in the size of farms. So again, this shows the increase of industrialization, the move from rural to urban, and the large farms. Also, agriculture zoning became sort of eliminated from city planning in the 1900s, and there were some gardens and green spaces incorporated into landscapes, but mostly just for looks and not for production. So the larger scale agriculture in urban areas was mostly confined to times of crisis, and other than that, it was in the rural areas. Suburban space set aside in the 1930s was an effort then to bring farming closer to cities. As I mentioned, it was usually only in crisis, when we saw farming of any type in cities, and this is farming during World War II, the victory gardens that were promoted as a way of feeding the population during wartime. In recent trends, especially since the recession, we've seen a big increase in interest in eating local and calling this locavores and people wanting to know their farmer, knowing where their food comes from. And consumers seem to be very supportive of urban agriculture for several reasons. One, they think it supports their local economy. There's often in small places and in bigger cities as well. It's, you know, buy locally. Support your local entrepreneurs. They want to understand where their food comes from, as we've become more and more removed from agriculture and less than 2% of the population is engaged in agriculture. It's become a curiosity. They want to know where their food's coming from. I know my own daughter, who never was interested in my vegetable garden when she's little, now that she's on her own, is, oh, Mommy, that's free food. Can you teach me how to do that? So I think that's a lot of the attitude of the millennials. There's a big concern about the environment and a concern about food security. So growing food closer to where the population is has become a trend and an interest. However, the opposite of this is there's a high cost of growing in urban areas. So moving agriculture back into the city faces several challenges. One is there's just not that much land available. The land that is available is often contaminated, which becomes less of a problem if we grow in greenhouses and get it up out of that land. But there's some things in the environment that are concerning. Trying to find funding to grow in a high-priced, you know, high land, high tax, high labor cost area is often difficult, as well as finding economies of scale, because if there is land available, it's often small plots. And the high capital and operating costs because of generally greenhouse technologies and the infrastructure is making it difficult. So we see basically if we move agriculture back into the cities, there's three basic ways that people seem to make it work. One is looking at the social business, where the focus is less on profit and more on social issues like education or research, the food insecurity, or the environmentally friendly focus so that we don't transport our food long distances. Another approach is targeted sales, where you look at either niche products or niche markets, and then a focus on cutting costs and trying to be price competitive. So if you look at niche markets, we see that farmers are looking for products where they can charge a premium price, looking at a niche product where there's not a huge supply, so they can get a high price. For example, Brooklyn Grange in New York City grows microgreens and heirloom tomatoes, both which command a high price for a large urban population in New York City. If we look at targeting a niche market, other farmers sell to high-end restaurants exclusively or grocery stores, and this is, you know, a market they can find in cities where there are quite a few high-end restaurants and supermarkets. And they're looking for consumers that are expecting to pay a higher price for these high-value products, and they can charge a premium. One study we found there was $1.06 premium on a pound of locally grown organic tomatoes in the urban areas. And urban consumers seem to be more likely to grow local food than the rural consumers. I know when I am up where my partner lives, he's in a rural area. Everybody still grows vegetable gardens there. I live in a city. I'm the only person I know that has my own vegetable garden. So it's not as unique to people in a rural area to know where their food comes from. A lot of it comes from themselves. So it's a big appeal for these urban consumers. So they're more likely to buy what they consider locally grown food than our rural consumers. And the market is helped by these demographics with lots of people that have these attitudes in the urban areas. So if you look at a social business model, then we're looking for alternative sources of funding. Often we have volunteers thinking agriculture's fun, willing to do it to help out putting youth to work or other social issues. They tend to focus on education, often aimed at youth or schools, looking at research, the environment, or the food security issue, trying to find, you know, put food in food deserts. When you look at the educational focus, then we can get funding from schools or government programs or donors. For example, the Harlem Grown in New York City focuses on education and helping to empower youth. And you see a picture of their hydroponic greenhouses. Arrow Farms in New Jersey is another example. They just got $1 million grant, and they partner with Phillips Academy Charter School. So again, an educational focus and bringing food closer to the consumer. Looking at another social business model is the food insecurity issue. Again, feeding people in food deserts, providing fresh produce there. And they probably don't look at high-end markets, although sometimes producers do both. The World Hunger Relief in Waco, Texas brings produce to the food deserts and also market at a discount cost. Another approach is cutting costs, finding these abandoned plots in cities where they can get the land for no cost or inexpensively. And this is more the traditional entrepreneurial approach. Again, you have to look at the contaminated soil issues, but other than that, there are some options there. Again, also with a social option of bringing more food to these food deserts. So just to recap, we see more of a split in different approaches in other than just cutting costs, looking at the social business of education, research, or food insecurity or environmental interest, targeting sales to niche markets where they can get a high value for specific markets or specific products, and then, of course, the cutting cost. So we were hoping to get more details, but again, these are all, everybody has their little niche, and so they're not so willing to share their information with us, but we were able to find a lot of literature and look at the reasons why people do what they do. Do we have time for questions? Okay. Any questions? Yes, way back in the back. We weren't looking at specific production. It was just, you know, what people are doing in the cities. Often they're in greenhouses, and some are using hydroponics, and some are using just the plots, you know, in the ground. So it's a mixture. Yes. Oh, you mean each person? They tend to focus on mostly greens, you know, mostly foods for eating. So microgreens or lettuce or, you know, things like that. And then the heirloom tomatoes. So mostly a few food products. Right. In the back? I'd say a little bit of both. When I have started projects to look for honor students, this is the one that captures their imagination more than anything else. It seems like I always get about 20 applicants. So it seems to me that young people are very interested in this for more of a social reason, that they think, let's put the food closer to where the consumers are. But of course, you need to make profit or have funding from some way. So I think my guess is it's more they have that interest themselves, but then it's how do we fund it? So they go after the funding. Yes. I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you're... Museums?
Yeah.
I was asked to repeat the question. Has this taken place at museums? I haven't seen a lot of that, but that's an option that seems to make sense. Yes. Public gardens, okay. If you call public gardens a museum, then I guess, yes. Yeah, so that is, I'm supposed to, I think you're capturing this, and so the recorded part, I need to repeat because you don't have microphones out there. But the museums, the comment was made that that's mostly for demonstration and not really for income, I think is what you were saying. And they donate, the public gardens donate their time and the produce. Again, it's mostly food and not so much ornamental that seems to have the appeal for these urban greenhouses. Yes. So that was a lot to repeat. But in Canada, a lot of the new immigrants are looking for their ethnic type vegetables and end up growing, I think you're saying, themselves on rooftop gardens. And often in the stores that have these ethnic vegetables, it's very high price, so then people can't afford them. So there's more movement to people growing their own. Okay. Thank you.